Alex Bizarides' debut book, Evolution Gone Wrong, The Curious Reasons Why Our Bodies Work or Don't Work, looks to answer why we still have dodgy knees, crooked teeth, and knee glasses, and many other things after millions of years of evolution. Alex is Professor of Biology at Lewis Clark State College, who specialises in anatomy and evolution. He joins us now live from Mexico. Alex, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
I hope you don't mind, but I'm going to ask both proximate questions, i.e. how things work, and ultimate questions, i.e. why things work. But first, a disjunctive question. You enjoyed writing this book, didn't you? It's quite entertaining as well as informative.
I had a really good time. I took my time doing it. Most of my job is teaching, so I couldn't just sort of pour myself into it for a year or two and knock it out. So I kind of had to take my time doing it, and I had a really good time doing it. I just learned so much, and even if it had never come to publication, I would have enjoyed the project. I just, with everything I could bring back to the classroom, I loved it. I hope to get to do it again.
What was the process that led you to decide to focus on the parts of the body that you talk about in the book and not others?
It was kind of born out of the classroom. It was the things that my students found most interesting that we discussed in class. The first topic that came up in class was why our teeth don't fit in our mouths, because we spend all this time looking at these textbook images of the mouth that are just the 32 teeth fitting in there perfectly. And I would talk to my students, and we would realize out of the whole class of students, 60, 70 students, there might be two students who hadn't, had braces or had wisdom teeth, or, that actually had straight teeth that fit in their mouth. So there were questions that came up like that. And I sort of explored which ones engaged the students the most, which were the most interesting, and then had to figure out how to organize it into a book.
And we will talk about teeth soon, but to come back to the book itself and how you wrote the book, because you've got to have a lifelong commitment and love for learning and a passion for it, for biology, particularly to write a book like this, don't you?
No question. And I don't think it's no coincidence. It's not a book I could have written in my 20s. I mean, I don't even think I was quite ready in my 30s. I'm in my mid-40s, and it took me a long time. I'm such a broadly trained biologist that when I started to teach anatomy and physiology, I had to dig in for quite a long time just to figure out how to understand the body's normal function when everything's running as it should, because that's for the most part what you teach in an anatomy and physiology class. It's downstream classes where the students learn where it all goes off the rails. And so it took me a long time to just kind of get all that anatomy and physiology to the point where I felt very comfortable with it, where I could then start thinking about these kinds of questions about why we choke so often, or why our teeth are, don't fit in our mouths, or why our backs are always giving us trouble. So yeah, it's been a long evolutionary process just for me to kind of get to the point where I could do something like this.
So let's look at some of the parts of the body. And I hope you don't mind me asking those why questions, because I think that's what a lot of the listeners will want to know, right?
Absolutely.
So let's start with teeth. And you asked a question in the book, actually, which comes first, the jaw or the teeth, which might actually help answer this question. But you've talked about the fact that we have 32 teeth in a jaw that is essentially far too small. So why so many teeth in such a small jaw?
Yeah, it has to do with our evolutionary past, and it's not that long ago in our past. When human ancestors came out of trees, 4 or 5 million years ago, and human ancestors started walking around on the ground, the diet changed considerably, and we needed these big, powerful jaws for this new diet of eating grass and tubers and these things that really required a lot of chewing. And at the time, we developed big, powerful jaws and had big, powerful teeth that fit in those jaws, and the match was decent. And then over time, as the brain got bigger and bigger, and we developed all these ways of processing our foods. So that's a big part of the chapters. I talk about the first use of tools by humans to cut meat off of bones, and the implementation of fire and control of fire is a big part of the story. And even more recent things like pottery, which allow us to cook food down to the point where it's mush and you hardly even need teeth. All those things eliminated the need for a large, powerful jaw. And in the early part of the chapter, I sort of set up the independence of teeth and jaws and how they're independent structures. And just because the jaw has shrunk over time, it doesn't mean the teeth automatically follow suit. And they're shrinking, but they haven't shrunk at quite the same rate. So now we're left with these jaws that have gotten quite small in the last 100,000 years. And and teeth that no longer fit in them. And for the most part, you end up with people having a mismatch there.
You've said that teeth are getting smaller. Will they ever get small enough to be able to fit comfortably in the jaw? Or are there things that are happening in current society and civilization which essentially delays that to the point where it might not happen at all?
Right. It's impossible to know what the match might look like in, 100,000 years or a couple hundred thousand years if humans are still lucky enough to be around on the planet. But I don't think the orthodontists are going to be out of work anytime soon. We've mostly, I feel like, largely removed teeth from the question of natural selection and the ways that we can fix them and make them pretty and straight, even if they weren't going to be pretty and straight naturally. So I think we're kind of stuck with our crooked teeth for quite some time, to be honest.
I found the section on eyes really interesting, and what I didn't, there's so many, I have to be honest with you, I was reading this for a whole week because there was so much I was writing down that I didn't know, that I've got a whole book of kind of information, which has taken me a while to digest, and I think it's fascinating. Eyes, the section on eyes I found really informative as well, because what you've said is vertebrate eyes originally evolved to view subjects underwater, and now we're stuck with them. Is that the reason why we have, for instance, an Asian population, so many young people who are, I think, nearsighted?
So eyes are kind of wild because they did have to deal with this issue of the vertebrate eyes starting in water and then going to land. But that happened 375 million years ago. So eyes have had quite a long time to kind of work through those kinks. And the human eye works remarkably well. So I actually place more of the blame with the eye on nurture rather than on nature, because one of the biggest hangups with the eye is that it needs an adequate amount of outdoor light in order to develop to the right length. So when kids are growing up, they need to be spending time outside or their eyes do not develop to the right length. And that is the current leading hypothesis for why we have this explosion of myopia in many populations around the globe, because you just have this whole generation of kids that are, growing up in the basement playing video games, and they need to be kicked outside for many reasons, just for general health. But one of them is to get their eyes to develop at the right length. So we have some quirks because our eyes developed in the water. We're stuck blinking all the time and keeping our eyes moist because we have a wet eye because it developed in a wet environment. But I think the main hang up with the eye has to do with some more modern aspects of culture and society.
And I will pick up with wet eyes soon. I've got a 10-year-old who loves, being on Advice Insight. So are you saying that my practice for my 10-year-old should be she can stay on the device so long as she's outside in natural light?
That's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, ideally, I'm kind of from the same perspective. If you can get her kicked off the device and get her to go outside, that's best. If the compromise has to be that she just takes the device outside, then we can live with that.
So let's talk about why did our eyes not dry the longer we spent more time on Earth, on ground, out of water?
It kind of drives to the principle of one of the main principles of evolution that I bring up in the book, was that you just can't start over. You just couldn't start the vertebrate eye over when you moved it to land. It probably was a pretty blurry image when animals first crawled out of the water for them, but it was a blurry image is still vastly better than no image at all. So we sort of started with these wet blueprints, and once you get rolling with that, there's no way to really go back. There's no way to just rip it and start over. And for that reason, we're still sort of stuck with the dry one as it is, as opposed to, something like an insect eye, the first, it's a completely different lineage of animals. Their eye is mostly evolved on land, and they have a completely different and kind of dry eye. It forms a totally different kind of image, but it has a different backstory.
Sorry, Alex, to interrupt. And so is that why we blink, to try and keep our eyes moist?
That's exactly right. That's why we're stuck blinking all the time. And you have to keep your eye moist one way or the other as a vertebrate, out of the water. And I bring up one example in the book of another animal that's taken it a different route. There are most species of geckos, instead of blinking, they don't have eyelids. They just lick their eyeballs every now and again to keep their eyes moist. So there are other creative solutions out there in the animal kingdom, but our solution is just to make many, many, many ounces of tears every day and run the windshield wipers that are our eyelids.
I think I know which one I prefer, if I'm honest with you, Alex. another question that has just come in, what are the pink things, the nub-like structures that we have in the nasal corners of our eyes? What are they for?
So, So another option for keeping your eye moist that some mammals use is they have another eyelid called a nictitating membrane that covers up their eye. It sort of makes this little covering over their eye that can keep it moist and keep it covered up if they're in a scrap, you know, like a dog or a cat gets into. So a lot of mammals still have these. Dogs and cats have them. Some people call it the haw. And you might see the haw sometime when your dog or cat is really sleepy, or if they've been in a fight, they'll draw it over their eyes, sort of as a rehabilitative measure. And it was something that was in our lineage. The little nub that you're referring to, the little pink nub, is the leftover remnant of the nictitating membrane. But at some point, it proved to not be as important in our lineage and was lost, and we've sort of went a different, maybe we started, you know, stopped fighting or stopped, you know, gathering and hunting and gathering in such a way that was dangerous for our eyes, or for some reason it was no longer selected for, and it's been lost in the human lineage, and now we're stuck blinking all the time.
You know, I have to tell you, and I think this could be a warning for people who read the book, when I'm reading the part on teeth, I'm automatically wanting to either go floss or brush my teeth. When I'm reading the part on eyes, I automatically start thinking about whether or not I'm randomly blinking or not. Oh, and when I read the part on back pain, I automatically started to feel sore in my lower back. So let's get to the back, because there are people who've already started asking questions around back pain. Why are our backs a problem to the point that it will continue? Back pain will continue to be a problem. People will get back pain. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when they get it.
That's right. So the issue are the curves that are built into the back. When hominids crawl out of the, you know, come out of the trees and pop up on 2 feet, there needed to be the only way that was going to work and be tenable was if there were a couple of curves in the back. There needed to be a lower curve to shift the center of gravity so that the center of gravity was placed more over the hips. Otherwise, the animal just topples forward. That's what you see in the other great apes. Their spines are C-shaped. And when they try and stand up on 2 feet, which they can do, like a chimpanzee or a gorilla can stand up on 2 feet for a short amount of time, but because they have this C-shaped spine rather than sort of more of an S with curves built in it, their natural inclination is to fall forward. So you need that curve down low to shift the center of gravity. And then you need one up top to place the head over the body so that the neck doesn't have to do a tremendous amount of work to keep the head in place. So the head can just be sort of positioned over the body. So those two curves are absolutely vital to bipedalism. You can't really have bipedalism without those curves. But they also take a lot of strength, core strength and back muscle strength to maintain that shape. And any kind of small injury can set it off on the wrong path. And just over time, as people age, those muscles weaken and those curves start to shift out of place. And that's where you start to get slipped discs and back pain. And it's just this thing. It's just this universal conundrum that I didn't realize that it's the leading global cause of disability. And it's something that you just see across cultures where people struggle to maintain the shape of their back. So there's a whole other book to be written about all the amazing aspects of evolution and how they've left us with these incredible features. You know, being able to walk on 2 feet is amazing and has all these incredible benefits. But I just thought the sort of more interesting story was the darker side of the coin.
So the main issue here is muscle weakness, right? It's to do with muscle weakness that leads to the injuries rather than the back itself, although that's just something that we have to deal with anyway. But it's the muscles weakening that are causing a lot of the issues.
I think that's the story for a lot of people. And I also think there's a whole other subset of people that are just flat unlucky, that just have curves that give them trouble from the get-go, like where either the curve is too deep or too shallow, and just even with a strong core, they just kind of got dealt a tough set of cards. So I think both can happen. You certainly have people that end up with back pain because they don't keep their core strong, but you have other people that are just dealt an unlucky shape. And that's just tough.
We've got some questions coming in, but we've got a comment from Rochelle who has said that we need to mention here the aquatic theory of evolution, which is now accepted by David Attenborough, although apparently he's been ridiculed by anthropologists as not being a scientist. But what role the aquatic theory of evolution here, Alex?
So there's this theory that's been around for a long time that there might have been a fully aquatic stage for the ape, that there's sort of this naked, it was something brought up by Desmond Morris many, many, many years ago. And that is not something that's sort of, there's not been a lot of evidence to my knowledge, to support sort of the full aquatic ape theory. What I talk about in the book is there are some paleoanthropologists and scientists who think there's now enough evidence to support the idea that there might have been sort of maybe a stage where there was a lot of more like wading involved, where there was this transitional period from trees to land may have involved a period where wading was an important part of our lives. And that might've sort of been the bridge to bipedalism. So that's as I understand it, sort of where the science sits on it right now. I'm sure as other fossils are unearthed that the understanding of it will continue to move forward, but that's where it is at this point.
You do mention wading in the book as well, yeah. Alex, in that section of the book. Gee, we haven't got much time left and I've got to get all these questions out. Okay. lots of questions or lots of feedback on knee injuries, ACLs, and pain to do with knees. Why are the knees so susceptible? And particularly, I think, more susceptible for women, but it's the men who are getting all the issues.
Yeah, I think the men are a little more prone to playing the sports that gets you into a particular amount of trouble, be it American football or rugby, things like that really put an ACL under a lot of stress. But certainly when women play those, play sports like soccer and basketball, they're absolutely prone to high rates of ACL injury. Also, so the simplest answer to the question is that when you distribute all the weight over two appendages instead of four, it asks a little bit too much of the joints. So that's kind of the simple answer to the question. And the rest of it has to do with the way that the weight is distributed, whereas the quadrupeds take a lot of that tension and stress and distribute it throughout their muscles. Whereas when you put the animal up on 2 feet, a lot of that tension and stress ends up being distributed into the ligaments and tendons instead, and so they're inherently prone to injury.
So, but it's not due to the contact nature of the sport, is it? Isn't it more due to the movement? So if it is more due to the movement involved in those sports, not necessarily the contact nature of them, or to avoid contact potentially, can we train ourselves so that we can reduce the possibility of those injuries, or as you say, is it just a part of the makeup?
That's a great question. And it's something that people are just starting to recognize and kind of work on is that, and there is, it's starting to look like you're right, that we may be able to, that we'll never be able to completely get rid of ACL injuries, but we might be able to lessen the impact of them with training about proper jumping and cutting techniques, because you're right. Many of the injuries are non-contact injuries. Somebody goes to plant a pivot foot and their knee blows out. I've blown out an ACL as I describe in the book, and mine was totally non-contact. And more often than not, when I see one occur, when I'm watching some kind of sporting match, it's in a non-contact way. So with proper training, starting from a young age, I think we can probably make a little headway on that issue.
Okay, birth and reproduction. So let's talk about birth. And in the book, you call it the Michael Jordan of pain. or the Mount Everest of pain, but the section is the Michael Jordan of pain, I think is how you've titled it. So why so painful? Is it because essentially babies are meant to be carried for a life of quadruped life rather than biped life? Or why is birth so painful, more painful than for most animals who, of course, birth their babies?
Yeah, it's just the perfect evolutionary storm for humans. So you have all of the sort of things that are rooted deep in our past. So the transition to bipedalism made the birth canal considerably tighter. There's irrefutable evidence of that done by a brilliant group out of Dartmouth led by Jeremy De Silva, who just himself put out a book called First Steps that if people like this book that I've written, I recommend that one because it follows in a similar vein. So that's the first problem, is that the birth canal was tight four or 5 million years ago, just with the switch to 2 feet. And then the brain tripled in size between then and now. So you take a birth canal that was already tight, then you make the head three times larger than it was. So those two factors. And then the sort of cherry on top is modern life. We're able to, in many parts of the world, mothers and their developing fetuses are afforded a degree of nutrition that has just never happened in the history of humans. So we're able to grow bigger and bigger and bigger babies. And you put those three things together, And it has kind of become the norm for women that birth is just this really, really difficult process. Of course, there are exceptions. You meet the occasional woman that, you know, that gave birth in the car on the way to the hospital because the kid just came out so easily. But I feel like more often than not, when I talk to women about their birth experiences, there's some pretty significant trauma involved.
And even morning sickness or MVP, Alex, why that? Why do so many women experience morning sickness during pregnancy?
And that's something that, so a friend of mine in graduate school worked on that issue. Sam Flaxman was his name. He teaches at UC Boulder now. And he wrote some really interesting papers with his advisor that suggested, sort of built on the work of some other people. So it wasn't totally original, but they came to it with some new evidence and new ideas that it's a protective mechanism, that during this period, it's typically the first trimester, maybe bleeding a little bit into the second. It's this period of time when the fetus is most susceptible to potential toxins, and that morning sickness is a protective mechanism to keep potential toxins from entering the body. And there's a lot of evidence for it. So it's more common in places where women might be exposed to meat, for instance, or to phytochemicals in certain plants. And there are some cultures around the globe where maybe they're only eating really, really fresh foods, and where there's much less morning sickness. So there's all these different pieces of evidence to suggest that morning sickness, while it doesn't make the process any more pleasurable for a woman, it might just be actually a sort of positive indication that her body is doing everything it needs to take care of the baby.
Yeah, I was going to say that it needs to do to protect the baby. Okay, let's talk about one of my... I've got this aversion to feet. I don't know what it's about. They freak me out. You've had some interesting experiences, which I'll get to, about tramping around the Isle Royale National Park. And then obviously you tramped in New Zealand as well. We'll get to that. But feet itself, I mean, they're just ugly looking things with, I don't know how many bones. You say 26. It feels like more sometimes. So what is that about? I mean, you talk about ostriches potentially have better feet for bipedals, right, than we do.
Yeah. So the wild thing with feet is that I feel like I keep coming back to these same issues. The two biggest issues that you deal with are the transition to bipedalism and these giant brains. And most of the problems that I talk about in the book are born of one of those two issues. So this is another one. You think about the pressures of the foot. When you're up in the trees, the foot needs to be this flexible structure, this nimble structure that can grasp things and grip things and grab onto branches and swing around. And that's what it does in other apes. And then you take that animal and you put it down on the ground and you say, all right, you're done doing that foot. Like, I know you've got all these little teeny little zillion little moving parts to do all this flexible stuff. Now I just need you to take a beating. We're just going to walk all day and we're just going to gather food. And that's been a really hard transition for the foot. It's not all that long ago that transition took place. And it's just been a little bit too much to ask for some people's feet. So the feet, you know, they sprain and they break down and the bones shift and they move and we get all kinds of foot trouble as a result. If, you know, animals that have been plodding around on the earth for a lot longer and stayed on the ground, like I bring up birds, you know, they've been bipedal for 100 million years and their foot is much better set up for it, as are the feet of many, many other mammals like ungulates.
And of course, you've had the experience at the Isle Royale National Park where you tramped and got blisters. And I think you've tramped in New Zealand as well. We don't necessarily have the softest ground either for tramping, I have to say to you. I have to say, yeah. Alex.
Yeah. And part of that, as I bring up in the book, it's not all nature. It's not all nurture. It's always a combination of the two. I remember I spent some time in New Zealand a lifetime ago. It must have been early part of 1997. I was there with a friend and we were sort of hitchhiking around and checking out just on the North Island. And I remember we got picked up by a family, and I don't remember what part of the island it was, but they took us to their home and took us in for a couple of days. And they were just really, really nice and generous, just the best experience. And I remember they had these two boys that just tore all around the farm. It was a small little town. They just tore all around the farm barefoot the entire time through like the most rugged terrain. And I remember it's left such an impression on me that if you just grow up in your life and you don't wear shoes all the time, boy, it would really toughen up your feet. Because my friend and I, we couldn't even conceive of walking through the kinds of brambles that they were walking through barefoot.
Is that part of the problem, Alex, around not wearing shoes per se, but the amount of people who wear shoes that are too tight for their feet. I mean, it's a heck of a squash when you're trying to put feet with 26 bones in them into really tight and confined shoes. Is that part of the issue that we've also got now?
I think it is part of the issue. I think the shape of shoes is part of the issue. And I think for the most part, people need to be put in shoes that give their feet a little more room to breathe, especially as their feet are developing. Some people's feet sort of are naturally going to stay narrow and not need to spread out. But other people's feet as they develop, I mean, I like to look at little kids' feet, and I feel like little kids' feet are a good representation. Sort of before they've been cramped into shoes, they have a nice little natural spread. And then it's not long after that they start kind of being forced back to the middle. So yeah, feet are another place where it all kind of comes together, the past and the present, to give a lot of people trouble.
Alex, congratulations on the book. It is your debut book, Evolution Gone Wrong, The Curious Reasons Why Our Bodies Work or Don't. Thank you very much for coming on the program.
I really appreciate you having me. Thanks a lot.
It was Alex Bizzarides. His debut book, again, is called Evolution Gone Wrong, The Curious Reasons Why Our Bodies Work or Don't.